got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Today, we are picking up my conversation with cancer epidemiologist Jeffrey Cabot. Last time, we talked about why the weed killer glyphosate, better known as Roundup and sold by Bayer, probably doesn't cause cancer. And we started to get into why the International Agency for Research on Cancer reached the wrong conclusion when they said that glyphosate is probably carcinogenic. So, with this part of the conversation, we're picking up the discussion where we were talking about the animal data that IARC looked at. And then we're going to go on from there to talk about the glyphosate trials in California and whether or not juries should be involved in determining if a chemical is carcinogenic or not. So with that brief intro out of the way, here's the rest of my conversation with Jeffrey Cabot.
And the final thing they did was they used, you've got to be careful about how you do statistics, and certain tests can be appropriate or inappropriate. Well, they didn't use a very appropriate test for judging the trend. In fact, these trends were not much in the way of trends. So what they really did was they selected certain studies to concentrate on, and they sort of massaged the data to say something that looked at in an impartial way. There just was no impressive trends in these rodent studies.
Okay, and that's very important, and correct me if I make any mistakes here, but that's very important because the epidemiological data that they had on agricultural workers, it was like right at the line of statistical significance, or it was right below it. So if they just had these epi studies, they couldn't have said it was a probable carcinogen. But because they had the animal data and because of the way they analyzed it, that boosted the result to a certain extent. And so that allowed them to say, hey, this is probably carcinogenic. Is that correct?
I think that's right. I think that's right. That's absolutely right. And that's true of the 41% too, that barely made it to statistical significance. We won't rehash that, but that if that's absolutely on target.
Okay, that's very interesting. So effectively, by shifting the numbers around or by excluding certain data points, the result would have totally flipped, and then, you know, maybe you don't have lawsuits against Bayer, who now owns Monsanto, and you don't have sort of a rallying cry against this really popular herbicide without this IARC monograph. So that's a really huge thing. I mean, this has generated so much controversy. And if this thing had come out a little bit differently, this monograph, then we possibly wouldn't have that. So that's, again, remember that. Okay, now, when I first heard this next item we're going to talk about, I was really shocked. And again, having some background as an epidemiologist, correct me if you hear any mistakes, but the scientist who was head of the working group was actually working on an updated part of the agricultural health study, which is it's a review of 54,000 agricultural workers and their exposure to pesticides. And at the time that the IARC monograph was written and then released, this update hadn't been published yet. And so that was their reason for not including that. But had they included it, that would have shifted their results too. So again, as an expert, give us some background on that. How big of a deal is that?
Okay. Well, up until this time, the data that was available was mainly from case control studies. And this is a much more quick and dirty, a more limited type of study for addressing this kind of question. The agricultural health study was, I would call it, a Cadillac study in which they the National Cancer Institute enrolled 54,000 pesticide applicators and farmers. This was in the mid-1990s, and they followed them for 20 years, roughly. And so this is a huge study, huge investment in collecting careful data. And the farmers were interviewed at the outset of the study. Some of them, portion of them, were re-interviewed a couple of years later, but they were all interviewed about their use of different products, different pesticides and herbicides, and, as I said, followed for roughly 20 years. And by the 2000 teens, 6,000 new cases of cancer had developed in this group, cohort of 54,000 farm workers. And that's a huge, solid number. And the researchers examined exposure to glyphosate, and they were able to compare not just were you exposed or were you not exposed, as was or much vaguer statements about exposure, as in the earlier studies, these case control studies I referred to, which you mentioned had questionable statistical significance. Here, the researchers defined five levels of exposure. So at the low end is no exposure to glyphosate. And then you have four levels from the lowest to increasing levels to high, to the highest level of exposure. So they looked at it in real, with a degree of detail that really is much more informative. And so what they found was that out of more than 20 cancers that they examined, there was no association between use of glyphosate and developing any one of these cancers, including lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and colon cancer, and prostate cancer, and on and on and on. So it's a very, very it's the kind of data that you really want on a question like this. And so it really does not provide any signal that there's something going on here with glyphosate.
Okay, so this is, as far as you're concerned as an expert, this is a high-quality study that really informs us about the cancer risk associated with glyphosate exposure. Now, this was not included in the monograph, and the IARC rules say if something's unpublished, you can't include it. And that seems strange to me because IARC is a group of cancer experts. So if there's anybody qualified to review an epidemiological study like this, it's the people that make up that group of experts. And then moreover, Aaron Blair, who was head of the working group at the time, he was one of the authors of the agricultural health study. So he obviously knew about it. I'm sure everyone else on the panel, well, I don't want to say everybody, I'm sure, the information was available to them. And so this is suspicious to me. And the argument they made is that, hey, it's unpublished. We only consider published data. But I just don't find that convincing. And then as a counterfactual, imagine if Bayer or Monsanto had done something like this. Like if they funded a study and they excluded data that was unfavorable to them, I mean, we would never hear the end of it, and rightly so. So give me your thoughts on that. I'm starting to rant a little bit.
I think you've got it exactly right, and that this has always been my reaction. And it's interesting. It's interesting that Bayer would be crucified, and rightfully so, if they suppressed a damning study that showed an effect, a really solid piece of work that showed that their product was dangerous. Okay. Here we have what is exculpatory evidence. And look how suppressing that doesn't, I find it very interesting, does not elicit anywhere near the kind of outrage, and partly because this is a very technical, abstruse discussion, but nevertheless, and there's something more. There's something more, and that is that I'm blanking. Hang on one second. The what needs to be added is that the everyone knew about the agricultural health study because there's an earlier publication that's cited by IARC and that's relevant and that dealt with glyphosate. The thing is that that paper was published in 2005, so there was much shorter follow-up and it had much smaller number of cases in it. But it was in the record. So everyone knew about the design of the study, about the plan, the study design, and the follow-up, and so forth. And so this is an added reason why, if they felt they needed to proceed with the report, as opposed to delaying it, they could have said it's important, although we have a general rule about not using non-published scientific reports. We feel that we have to make an exception in this case because here we have results from far and away the largest and most carefully done study on the question. Okay, so I would like to see someone argue that no, they shouldn't have done that. And if they didn't feel that they wanted to refer to this unpublished results, because the manuscript was out there. Aaron Blair says he had too many results to publish them all in the same paper. Well, you can publish multiple papers. It really doesn't explain that it wasn't published or that it wasn't in press. And they had the manuscript and they had the results. And people on the panel, the working group, should have known about the results and taken them into account. And finally, they could have delayed the publication of the monograph until the results were published. There was no urgent need, except that there was someone who was pressing to get this out there. And I'm referring to Chris Portier. And then within a little over a week, he became a witness for the plaintiffs in several cases against Monsanto. So there are many questions about this IARC assessment.
Yeah, it's very important to highlight that. And I'll put a couple of links at the Genetic Literacy Project. We've run several really good research articles about this, and including transcripts from court depositions and emails that have been brought to light as a result of open records requests. And so there's some really interesting issues there that people need to explore. I'm not going to make a judgment on those, but I think look at those when we post them, when this episode goes live, because those are really important for people to be aware of. Now, one other thing, and then we can move on to something else. But other agencies, say like the EPA in the United States, they regularly consider unpublished data. So they look at peer-reviewed stuff that's already been published. But when a company wants a registration for a product, they have to submit data directly to the EPA. So it wouldn't be unprecedented for IARC to look at something that hadn't appeared in a journal yet. Is that correct?
I agree. If studies are done by known scientists at known institutions, especially using a study that's published earlier results, as was done with the agricultural health study, I don't see how you can leave that out. It just there's no way I can get my head around it. If you're interested in the best data on the question.
Okay, and another point related to the EPA and some of these other agencies Now the EPA and the European Food Safety Authority and Health Canada, all these institutions, they do risk-based safety analyses. And so they do consider exposure and, or excuse me, length of exposure and dose. And so I would say these are higher quality reviews than IARCs. And the point I'm making here is that these agencies are very risk averse. And I had a former FDA scientist on a recent episode of the show named Henry Miller. And when he was there, and he worked in the related aspect, but in the Office of Biotechnology, and he said it used to drive him nuts is that they would intentionally drag their feet when they were going to approve a drug or approve a device or something, because they didn't want to be blamed for letting something out onto the market too quickly if it was going to harm people. And so for the EPA and the FDA and these other agencies, for them to still approve this herbicide and then to say multiple times now in the last several years that it's safe, I think that is a very important witness to why this product isn't going to harm anybody. Because if they had the slightest inclination that it was dangerous, then they wouldn't come out like they did, and they did just earlier this week. And they reaffirm that glyphosate won't cause cancer. So offer some insight on that. Am I off base there?
No, you're not. And the GLP has that terrific infographic summarizing all these agencies from Australia to Germany to Canada and so on to the EPA. What a lot of people don't realize. That we've learned a lot from mistakes in the past and from experience over decades. And regulators at EPA and other agencies, people don't appreciate how regulation is done. And regulators build in a margin of safety of several orders of magnitude above and beyond the level at which adverse effects have been rigorously documented in studies. So they're not saying, oh, well, people can tolerate a certain amount and we're going to play roulette with that. No, they build in a substantial margin in case the studies aren't as precise as you think they are. So that's one point. And another point is that the EU is considering phasing out glyphosate and is under pressure from politicians and activists and so forth. And one of the ironies of the situation is that if glyphosate is banned, farmers will be harmed. They're almost universally against a ban. And they will have to use older and more toxic compounds, such as copper sulfate. And so this underscores how important it is to let the science, and we're talking about the best quality science, to let it be heard. And not listen to the siren song of activists who have a quarrel with modern agriculture and the use of genetically modified crops and the politicians who sometimes cater to them. So the regulatory process ought to get more appreciation, more understanding than it gets.
Moving on then, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that these companies like Bayer, and who owns Monsanto now, and these other big agrochemical companies, these seed companies, they're frequently accused of quote-unquote capturing these regulatory agencies and unduly influencing the regulatory reviews of their products. What do you make of that objection? Is that because, and the reason I ask, I'm sorry to interject and interrupt myself, but if what these activist groups say, and if what these lawsuits say is correct, then it means that dozens of regulatory agencies all over the world are aiding and abetting Bayer, or they're somehow influenced by them. And I find that really hard to believe. And again, for some of the reasons we were just talking about, what do you think of that objection to this research we've been talking about?
Well, I can't speak directly to it. I have a hard enough job, or I'm busy enough just trying to keep up with the science and read the relevant articles and the literature. And so I stay clear of these, these transcripts and certainly of some of the claims that are thrown around. I've seen claims of ghostwritten articles and so forth. What I would say is that the first, just as we have to recognize that scientists are not saints and that they're human and that they're fallible and that the literature is fallible, by the same token, we need to realize that corporations are not, they have their interests and they're not necessarily models of probity. But I would have to see a specific charge. And I'm only going by the scientific, by the published scientific literature and commentaries on it by people with training in relevant disciplines. So how companies handle PR and how they do things, I know that what I'm aware of is, and this doesn't speak to this situation, but often companies will yield to adverse publicity, as they did with BPA, and they will cut out a compound for which there's no evidence of harm, period. And so there are a lot of different things that can go on, and I think the prime question is what does the science tell us? And I don't think this science, certainly not the agricultural health study, certainly not all of the rodent studies, these have not been manipulated by the companies.
Yeah, it's a good point. And a follow-up is, I know a lot of the, of course, we're chatting right now, but I know dozens of other scientists that work in these fields. They work at universities. They have no affiliation with industry. And in fact, it's like 60% of people that work in plant breeding and agriculture and crop biotechnology. They don't have any relationship with these companies. And so, at least personally, I find it hard to believe that not one of them would speak up if they thought that Bayer was trying to pull the wool over eyes. And I have the same suspicion about you. If you saw them publishing studies that were low quality or looked like they were manipulated, I don't think you would stay quiet. I think you would speak up. And we were talking.
I'm an equal opportunity critic. Just have it in my blood that I don't like shoddy. I don't like claims that are made based on crummy research. I'm allergic to it, and so I call it out wherever I find it. And one thing, sort of biographical, is that not many scientists are in that situation where they can tear down something because you're not going to endear yourself to your colleagues. Think about that, and the person reviewing your next grant or reviewing your paper. I mean, you have to pull your punches. So whereas because of my situation and because I'm not, I want to write for the public as well as publish scientific articles, I feel I can't be fettered by any allegiances. People have wanted to pay me, like scientific communications companies in Washington wanted to pay me for articles that I was writing on Forbes. And I said, I can't do this, and I can't write the in a free and critical and a zesty way if someone is paying me for this. Just the two things are incompatible in my, you know, for me. But there is one has to look out for conflicts of interest, and there are shady things that go on. But on the other hand, people grasp at all sorts of nefarious things. I don't see how that could affect the scientific judgment in this situation. Ghostwritten papers and things like that. I mean, ghostwritten papers they're going to be commentaries and things. And as you said, I don't see how it could change the weight of the evidence of these studies, and certainly it's not going to affect the agricultural health study results.
Very good. Okay, so anyways, the only takeaway there I would say is that there are people out there like Jeffrey, if they saw something that was junk, they would say, hey, this is junk and you guys shouldn't put out junk, you know. So it seems like there's a bit of a self-correcting mechanism there. It's not perfect, I understand. But I just don't think they would get away with it if they were truly doing something nefarious.
Right.
Okay, final question then, because, I mean, the reason we're still talking about this after, 4 years after this monograph came out is that now we have over 11,000 lawsuits that are pending against Bayer over glyphosate causing cancer. And they've already lost two cases, which is a big deal for them as a company. And it's a big deal for I think people that like science, because, I mean, it's an example, I think, of the data being ignored, more or less. And so my question to you is, do you think that courts have any legitimate role in evaluating the carcinogenicity of a chemical or the health risk of a chemical?
I think these trials, the two trials that you're referring to, in which awards were given, I guess they're going to be challenged and appealed. But I think that the trials that we witnessed with juries are not a way that you're going to get at the truth of an issue like this. You can't resolve issues like this before a jury made up of lay people. You have opposing testimony, and the judge has to decide which testimony to allow. So they allowed certain experts to present evidence. And when you're dealing with a scientific issue which has different interest groups who have such strong opinions and such strong emotions, and that's the environment in which this is taking place, and then some poor person, groundskeeper who used defoliants, who used the herbicide, comes in and has cancer. This normal people, it's overwhelming that something must have caused this poor person's illness, and they've heard so much about this horrible chemical out there that you have to err on the side of the claim that it's glyphosate that caused the person's illness. But this is so far from scientific judgment that I think it's they used to say military, I forget how it went, but this is to symphonic music what military music is to, you know, just we're in a totally different realm if you're trying to make arguments about the science in a venue like this, in a situation like this. You're asking for emotional and uninformed reactions. But so that's talking about these jury trials. There is another possibility, which I don't know how that will play out. That is what's called a Daubert hearing on the science before a judge or a panel of judges, perhaps, that would rule on the scientific evidence. So that seems to me to be a mechanism by which you could arrive at a rational decision, judgment about the scientific evidence. It would take, you know, it would take a course, a course given by high-powered people to really train the judges. That's what it would take.
Right. And I want to, I'll let you go after this, I promise, but I'm all fired up. One example of that, and I heard you talk about this with Kevin Folta, who's a plant scientist at the University of Florida, and he really gets up the noses of these activist groups. I'm not sure why, but in any event, when you guys were talking about that other meta-analysis that we were talking about earlier, you guys said that the lag period for the lymphoma to develop was 20 months, I believe?
20 years,
excuse me, little slip there. So it was 20 years, and then in that trial, his cancer developed much, much sooner than
that. In 1 year.
Right.
Within 1 year, I think, yeah.
Oh, okay, so even the data that they're ostensibly relying on, because those case controls went into the IARC monograph that also went into that meta-analysis, and so the data don't even line up. Even in court, but the jury, you know, probably isn't going to catch that. And I mean, if I wasn't paying so close attention and talking to people like you, I wouldn't have caught that.
And people commented on that typically when if you're looking for what caused the cancer, the causes lie further back in the past, and this person's cancer seemed to have occurred very, very quickly on the heels of exposure, but that's how, you know, there must be some adage that I'm groping for, you know, it's just not the right forum where emotions are on display and where people are facing fatal disease, and their families are facing a fatal disease, and you're not looking at any of the other things that occurred in this person's life. I mean, I guess the defense will bring up those kinds of things, but the chances that it was the chemical exposure, based on what we know, exposure to glyphosate that caused it, is what it really points up. Is how little we know about a disease like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It comes back to my point that there's a difference we should always keep in mind between studying something and having that mean that what you're studying is of paramount importance. We wish that were so, but it's probably the case only in exceptional circumstances that you hit on something really, really important. You hit on, oh, smoking causes 90% of lung cancers. That's not where we're at with studying things like glyphosate.
Right. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but they still don't really know what causes NHL. Is that the case? I mean, it's such a rare disease, and I know it's being researched, but before this whole controversy sparked, that was my understanding, is that it's, you know.
It's true. It's okay. True. And it's true of so many cancers, but particularly of rare tumor like that. Furthermore, and we didn't get into this, there are many subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And there, from everything we know, one would suppose that they are, these different types are influenced by different factors. So it's not, so we crudely study epidemiology, you crudely do a study of all non-Hodgkin's lymphomas lumped together, but they're not, there are real differences, these different variants of the disease. So it's even fuzzier than the, you know, the headlines and the studies like the mutation research study indicate. So you have a crude exposure that you're correlating with a crude disease entity. And so what is the solution? The solution is we do some quick mashing together of some very, very different studies, and you pull a number out of that soup, and you have your headline.
Wow. I'm almost speechless, not quite, but...
Well, I say this because one of my themes is that there's really, really stellar science out there in biology and in medicine and, you know, and in astronomy and so on. And that is stuff that we should really be thankful for and we should appreciate. But we have to know how to distinguish between the really the stuff that really puts us in a better position, that is a benefit to humanity, and to other stuff which may be worth doing, but didn't arrive at any clear cut result, and other stuff which really, and we've given a couple of examples, really should be ignored. And to go back to IARC, because you raised this point about IARC and how should IARC go out of business, which other people have raised this issue, and what is, how should we view IARC? I think that if IARC's been in existence for over 40 years, and it has a very high, good reputation on the science side. For example, studies overseeing worldwide collaborations on human papillomavirus in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And so IARC has a justified reputation for having made real contributions. The IARC monographs are the part of IARC which is causing a problem and is causing an enormous amount of confusion. And my view is this: if IARC were in the business of summarizing and updating the scientific literature for scientists, that would, doing accurate, critical, comprehensive reviews of asbestos, of talc, of glyphosate, and if they continued to do a good job, if they maintained the standard that you would expect, that would be one thing. But it should be for scientists. That's the distinction I'm making. If they want to study hazard and they want to look at every possible angle, that's fine. But this is not the kind of thing that should be that you make press releases from and broadcast it to the public, that red meat is a class 1 carcinogen, that that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen, that cell phones are a possible carcinogen, that DDT is a possible carcinogen. I have a real problem with this announcing. They know that the end consumer of these things is the public, and they clearly want to get attention from the public. To me, this is wrong, because most of this stuff is very academic and it's not relevant. It's not relevant to the public. The cell phones thing that I've written about, as well as others, was not really, the public didn't need to get a skewed assessment that played up a few findings here and there, and that scared the hell out of people. If they concentrated on doing the most thorough and careful job, and then came up with some other mechanism for, well, what does this rise to? What level of concern does this rise to? Then I would have no problem with IARC at all.
Right. I'll have to have you back on sometime to talk about Proposition 65 out here in California, because that has been such a...
Well, they feed at the IARC cross.
Right.
That way, whatever IARC announces, they pick it up. So, so Bob Tarone actually was back visiting in California, and he told me that he was sitting in a coffee shop, and there was a sign attached to the plate glass window, and the sign said, this environment could increase your risk of cancer. So Bob Tarone asked the server, what is that sign referring to? And she's saying, oh, we use Windex to clean the windows. That's what it was. So this is, and then coffee is perhaps the ultimate example. This is so silly and so confusing, because if everything is equally cause for concern, then that's not going to help anybody if you don't make rigorous distinctions.
No, not at all. And I'll have you back. But I mean, flip-flops, toothbrushes, aspirin, coffee, trips to Disneyland. I was at dinner with my wife the other night.
These are fascinating things. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's like we were at dinner and we were eating garlic bread with spaghetti. And of course, acrylamide is a byproduct of cooking grains. And so they had a Prop 65 warning, because apparently garlic bread is going to boost your risk of... I wrote an article about it, but I'll have you back sometime and we can dive into that, because that's fascinating too. But
great.
Tell people where they can find out more about you. I know you've written a couple books for a popular audience. Go ahead and give a plug for those. Do you have a website? Are you on Twitter? Let everybody know.
I have a website which has tabs that direct you to all of my articles, to all of my scientific papers, and to describe the books and give comments on the and reviews on the books. And that is just Jeffrey Cabot, G-E-O, Jeffrey spelled G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, Jeffrey Cabot, .com, all one word. And then I am on Twitter. And those are the two main places.
All right. Well, I hope this was a good intro for people, but go check out his website and check out his books and follow him on Twitter, because he publishes interesting stuff. I follow you on Twitter. All the cool kids are doing it, everybody. All right. Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Cameron, thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening in. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes and check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. We'll see you next time.